this so you can book open.
All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started. For those of you that are getting ready to take the Med Micro final, today will actually be a really good review because a lot of the stuff that we're going to do builds off of material that we covered in some of the regulation sections. And in fact, a lot of the slides may have been familiar. What I try to do is to use that information as a foundation and to give a lot of about how the actual mechanisms work. We spend a lot of time talking about how to look for mutants, how to look for phenotypes, how to design things. My lecture style tends to be very informal, so I'll wander around. I like to ask lots of questions. If you respond, it helps. Even if you don't know the right answer, response is better than no response. And if you have questions, ask them. So I'll stop and we'll work through stuff, but we're not afraid to use the board or do whatever we need to. So, all right. So then today we're going to start with regulation, and there's four major questions. So and probably all of you have seen these questions before in Med Micro, based bacteriology section. So spend just a couple of minutes talking about why we study regulation, why it's important. And then the bulk of the time today, and then even in the, not the next lecture, but the lecture after that I give, will be really how we study regulation and the mechanisms of regulation we use in prokaryotes. All right, so then why does it need to be? Why does gene expression need to be regulated? All right, and the example that we gave before is the fact that really bacteria are going to experience lots of different environments. And so bacteria don't live in one place for their entire lifetime. They often move around. And so we talked about this previously in the context of pathogenic bacteria, many of which are found in environmental reservoirs and then enter a host. And obviously what they see in the environment is going to be quite different than what they're going to see inside a human body, right? Also, if you think about within a human host, bacteria have the ability to colonize different infection sites. So what a bacteria might see in the stomach is probably quite different than what it might see in the large intestine or the small intestine. So based upon the microenvironment where they're located, they're going to need to express certain genes that are going to help facilitate their survival. And then need to express certain genes that are going to help facilitate uptake of nutrients or surviving different stresses. Going backwards the whole time because I'm triggering. Okay, what about why is it important to study gene regulation? The example that we've given before is the fact that certain pathogenic microbes actually only produce certain virulence factors when they're inside of the host. So they have mechanisms of regulating that gene expression based upon environmental signals. So by understanding how that regulation occurs, it gives us the opportunity to perhaps design therapeutics that are going to be able to prevent expression. And the example that we gave here was with Vibrio cholerae, which causes cholera disease. You've probably seen this before. It's a massive secretory diarrhea, and the disease is mainly due to the production of a toxin called cholera toxin. That toxin is only primarily expressed inside the host, so it's not expressed very much in the environment. So by understanding the signals and the regulatory factors that actually control its expression, it can target those regulatory factors. So we typically talk about these things within the context of pathogenic organisms, but most of the examples we're going to talk about today don't have to do with really pathogenesis per se. We're going to talk about the lac operon, the era operon, and those working out regulation in those physiological sets of genes really giving us a foundation for many applications to other systems. So it's very basic research in a non-pathogenesis setting, but it really, the foundations for regulation is the same regardless. All right. And then the bulk of what we're going to talk about is really how expression is regulated and how we go about studying. All right, so this probably looks familiar. Does everybody remember all the biochemistry of going from DNA to RNA to protein? That looks familiar. And then we do promoter operator structure. So what's the promoter composed of? What specific things are found in promoters? What is a promoter? Go ahead. You don't have to raise your hand, you can just answer. Okay, so this, we're going to start codon. So typically start codon means protein, which could be translation. Okay. So what's a promoter for? Okay, so the RNA polymerase does attach in the promoter, and so promoters are important for transcription, right? So don't confuse transcription and translation. So transcription is the production of RNA, so using a DNA template to make RNA, right? And then translation is using that messenger RNA template to make protein. So don't confuse those two. All right, so then a start codon usually, or a start signal, start codon is the first triplet found for putting in that first amino acid for translation. All right, so a promoter is a site where the RNA polymerase is going to bind, right? And that's obviously important for starting transcription. What are the specific sequences where the RNA polymerase interacts called? Shine-Delgarno sequence. People think that's right? Okay. Once again, Shine-Delgarno is for translation. So that's where the ribosome is going to bind. Okay, the Tata box. All right, what's another name for the Tata box? Minus 10. All right, so there's the minus 10 and the minus 35. So promoters always have a minus 10, minus 35. And that's the site where the RNA polymerase is going to first start. So make sure you sort out those details, and I'll show you more pictures as we move through. All right. Some genes also have sequences that are attenuator sequences. And remember, we talked about attenuation, and we'll go back through attenuation if you don't remember it. But attenuators would be important for halting transcription. So promoters are where transcription starts, and attenuation helps control it, gives termination, premature termination of transcription. And then, of course, there's an open reading frame, or an ORF, O-R-F. That's how it's often abbreviated. That's actually the component that is encodes the gene. All right, and then at the end there's a stop signal. Right? It tells the RNA polymerase that it's time to stop. All right, so we've got starts and stops. So then transcriptional control can be controlled at the level of initiation. So it does transcription start from here, and we will talk about both positive and negative regulation of initiation, and then also there's termination. So attenuator sequences would be used for terminating transcription. So it doesn't stop it from beginning, it just causes it to end early. All right, so once you have RNA that's made, messenger RNA, you can also get regulation at that level. All right, so you can have antisense RNAs that are made, and so antisense RNAs would be able to reach a homology to the message, and so they can interact and actually base pair with the message. Right? And so you can imagine that that could do either two things. That could be either to cause positive or negative regulation. If it base pairs and blocks the Shine-Delgarno sequence, then the ribosome can't bind, right? So you would see no translation. On the other hand, there are examples that we'll talk about later, I think, two lectures from now, where binding of the antisense RNA actually opens up a secondary structure and
makes the Shinar kernel accessible to the device. Okay. So antisense can also regulate either negative or positive. All right. So also we have to think about the fact that messenger RNA isn't constantly stable. It can be degraded. So there's a turnover rate. So how long does it stay in the cell? And that can be controlled by different factors. And then translational, that messenger RNA gets translated. All right, so the translation initiation would be controlled by the antisense and degradation. And then once the protein is made, once again, proteins don't hang around forever. They can get broken down, and that's done by proteolysis. It's a breakdown of specific proteins, specific even regulatory proteins. Once again, can control the entire process. All right, so let's look at some of these things in a little more detail. And today we're going to spend just about all of our time on the top section, so talking about transcriptional control. All right, so then here's a figure that shows that minus 10, minus 35 region of the promoter. So here's the promoter, and here's the blow-up of it. What is the plus 1? What's the plus 1 sign? I'm sorry, say that again.
Initiation protein?
It's actually the first nucleotide added in the growing message, right? So it's really the that first nucleotide. So it would be the initial nucleotide. Okay? So that's always called the plus one. So the plus one is found on the messenger RNA. Alright? What's this? Anybody read what this is? The sigma factor. Okay? So what's the role of the sigma factor? Right, so it actually directs the RNA polymerase to the promoter that's going to be controlled. Right, so the sigma factor is the component that actually interacts at the minus 10, minus 35 initially. So the RNA, yes. It's actually part of the RNA polymerase, so it's more like this, but it comes, I'm just showing the interaction here, so it doesn't bind first and then recruit, it's more like it. You get a holoenzyme that's formed. Okay, so by holoenzyme, I mean that it's the RNA polymerase composed of all five subunits. So there would be a sigma factor, a beta prime, and the two alpha subunits. And so that complex gets recruited, but it's the sigma factor that directs the holoenzyme to certain promoters. And that's based upon the binding affinity of the sigma factor for certain sequences. So certain sigma factors prefer certain sequences, and we'll talk more about sigma factors later. So now just remember that it's important for directing the RNA polymerase to specific promoter regions. And it is the factor that interacts with the minus 10, minus 35.
Does it bind entirely? Or does it span the negative 10 all the way to the negative 35, the sigma?
So it primarily interacts here and here. So it's more of a footprint. So it's not contacting the whole region, but it's covering. Okay? All right, so then RNA polymerase, we said that the sigma factor is important for recruiting the holoenzyme. So when I say holoenzyme, it means all five subunits. So it interacts, all right? And so once it interacts, you get what's called the closed complex, right? And then once that happens, polymerase starts doing its job, meaning it opens up the DNA strand so transcription can begin. And at that point, the sigma factor is actually released. Right, so it basically gets recycled while the rest of the polymerase, what we call the core enzyme, is finishing transcription. So those are the basic steps of transcription initiation. Right, so then in terms of a blow-up of that, just looking in a little more detail, shown here. So here's, once again, our minus 10, the Tata box, the minus 35. You can see the sigma factor is going to interact at these two sites. All right. And then the beta and beta prime are actually large subunits, and they have, they call jaws at the front that interact with the DNA and are important for the actual unwinding and relaxing of the structure. The alpha subunit is actually a little more complex than we classically draw it. So it actually has two separate domains. So that on the N-terminus, that portion of the subunit actually interacts with the beta and beta prime. And then the C-terminus portion of the protein can interact with other sections of the DNA. And often those, that interaction is very important. And there are sequences that are called up elements. These are often AT-rich elements, where the C-terminal portion of that, the alpha subunit, is going to interact. And so what happens that you can, let's think about mutagenesis. So in theory, for a lot of promoters, all you need is the minus 10, minus 35 to get expression, right? Because that's enough to direct the RNA polymerase there. But in cases where you have an up element, if you now mutated the sequence, what you find is that you're going to get decreased expression of that gene. So this interaction of the alpha subunit at this region is very, very important for controlling expression. Okay. And in fact, the interactions that occur can be lots of different types of interactions. So the up elements can be arranged different places on the DNA. Right? So here is an example where there are two up elements, and they're actually very proximal to the minus 10, minus 35 region. Sometimes you might have a single up element, so only one of the alpha portion of the alpha subunit is going to interact, and that's called proximal because it's close, and then sometimes it's a distal one. So it means that you can't just simply look at the sequence and look a certain number of base pairs up like you do with the minus 10, minus 35. It's a little more complex. It's not always easy to define where these elements are. Yes?
So it's always extreme minus 10, minus 35.
In this case, yes. So in prokaryotic sequences, I can't think of an example where it's down. And the reason for that is that you would block progression of polymerase. And typically in prokaryotes, which is different than eukaryotic system, these important elements are going to be pretty proximal to the actual promoter region. So they often will fall within a few hundred bases. That's not always true in eukaryotic systems. Sometimes regions that are important may be thousands of base pairs away. That usually doesn't happen in bacteria. Usually they're pretty close. So they're usually pretty close to the actual minus 10, minus 10.
The alpha CTD is a protein that binds to the up element on the DNA, and then the alpha subunit of the whole enzyme then binds to alpha CTD. Is that, or
this whole thing is the alpha subunit of the polymerase. So
the alpha CTD is
part two domains of the same protein.
Oh, okay.
So it's an internal domain and the C-terminal domain. Okay. All right. So it can be pretty complex. All right, and then in thinking about genes, we talk about genes being one of two types of genes. So there are constitutively expressed genes, and so that for constitutively expressed genes, basically those genes are going to be expressed all the time. So they're going to not be regulated. Does anybody know another name for constitutively expressed genes? There's something else, housekeeping genes. So we commonly call those housekeeping genes. We often use them as controls for experiments because of their regulation, their level of expression doesn't change, then it's something we can compare to, basically as a standard. Right? So housekeeping genes. And then, of course, there are the regulated genes, and those are the ones that are being, the amount of expression is being controlled by different factors or accessory proteins. Right? So that can be either negative or positive regulation. And words that should be familiar to you by now are repressor proteins and activator proteins. So a repressor protein would decrease expression, and an activator would increase expression. All right, so then this is basically just another representation of our promoter. So here's our minus 10, minus 35, the transcription start site, which would be the plus 1, right? The first base that's added. And here is the core enzyme after it's attached, the alpha and beta subunit of the polymerase, though it's drawn a little differently than you saw any others. The alpha unit subunit should be on the back, but you can see that it's binding. And so then how does negative regulation occur? What do you think a repressor protein, the most obvious place a repressor protein might interact to be? On the sequence. Okay, so anywhere in the promoter. So since you have to have a physical interaction here, anything that binds in this region is going to block that physical interaction. Okay? So if the repressor sits down anywhere in here, then it's going to sterically hinder the polymerase from being able to interact. So it's really steric hindrance that's important for this type of repression. So we often talk about when we talk about repressors, many repressors require a co-repressor. Okay? So a co-repressor would be some factor that interacts with a repressor that makes it active. So a good example of a co-repressor might be thinking about iron-regulated genes. So if there's a regulatory protein called FER, which primarily functions when it's bound to iron. Right. So then iron would be the co-repressor for that protein. So co-repressors may be other proteins, but they don't have to be. They can be metal ions, they can be other factors. Okay. And then we also talk about inactivators. And so that would be any substance that when it binds to the repressor would make it not active. And a good example of that would be for the lac operon that we're going to talk about. In fact, that lactose actually binds to the lac repressor and activates it. All right, so then let's talk about some specific examples. And we're going to start with the lac operon. Right? And so regulation of this operon is based upon the fact that if a bacteria has the choice, it prefers to use glucose as a food source as opposed to lactose. Does everybody remember why that is? Why would a bacteria prefer to use glucose as opposed to lactose? That's right. All right, so if you look at the metabolic pathway, which I think is the next one, lactose is up here, and it actually gets broken down through two reactions to make glucose. So if you can start with a product that's further down, it makes a lot more sense because it requires less energy. You don't have to produce these enzymes. All right, so they'd rather use glucose. All right, and so because of that, the bacteria have come up with a very complex system of regulation of the genes that are important for metabolizing lactose. All right, and that's called the lac operon. What's an operon? What do I mean when I say operon? Okay, that's kind of right, but not exactly. What's a very specific definition? What's an operon? Right, so it's a series of genes controlled by a single promoter. All right, so then how does this actually work? Alright, so here are the players that we're going to talk about. So here is the lac operon. So you can see there are three genes that are being regulated by a single promoter here. So this would be the lac promoter. So downstream of the promoter, there's a sequence called the operator. So an operator is just a sequence where activators are where different components may bind and affect transcription. Right, so in this case, the operator is where the repressor is going to bind. It's actually physically downstream of the promoter in this case. Right. So then the structural genes that encode those enzymes are lac Z, Y, and A, and those are here. Right. And then the regulatory sequences we're interested in are lac I, which is found elsewhere on the chromosome, so it's not part of the offer. So it is not part of this system. It has its own promoter, so that's P, represented here by PI. So this is the promoter for this gene, black repressor. The promoter here that controls expression of this operon, and then the operator sequence for the lac repressor is in the body. All right, so then what would happen in the case of no regulation, right? So RNA polymerase should be able to come and bind to these separate promoters, and you would see the production of mRNA, which ribosomes would associate with, and then you'd see the production of proteins. But what happens is that when this gene is expressed, when the lac repressor is expressed, it actually comes and binds to the operator of the lac operon. So it binds in this region here. So it's a diffusible regulatory protein. It's made elsewhere in the cell, and it comes and binds to this sequence. And when that happens, it basically prevents the ability of the RNA polymerase to transcribe through the sequence. So it doesn't block the polymerase binding at the minus 1035. It just physically blocks its ability to move further down the DNA. All right. So the repressor is going to bind there. And the repressor is actually constitutively expressed. So this promoter is not regulated in the same way. So it's constitutively expressed, so the repressor is going to always be being made in this case. So another visual depiction of the region is here. So you can see the promoter is this minus 10, minus 35 for the polymerase binds, and then the operator is physically downstream. So binding of the repressor here is going to block transcription for C. All right. So there are a couple of important things that I think you need to keep in mind, and that's the fact that the repressor actually doesn't function as a monomer, and that's going to be important when we talk about different mutants that have been found in this region and how that affects regulation. Right. So it doesn't work as a single protein. It actually forms an oligomeric structure, makes a tetramer. Those four subunits interact, and then that is what's competent for binding at the operator. So it has to be a tetramer. All right, so then what happens if you now add lactose to the system? Right? So when lactose is present, it's going to act as an inducer for the system. So basically what happens is lactose gets into the cell, it now goes and binds to a binding pocket on the lac repressor. That causes a conformational change, which now makes the repressor not competent for binding at the operator sequence. So if lactose is present, it basically inactivates the repressor. So if the repressor can't bind, then you're going to see transcription and translation. So now you're going to make all these components you need to utilize lactose, actually to use the sugar. This is reversible. So if now the lactose all gets metabolized, then you don't have to necessarily make new repressor. The repressor that was there with lactose no longer bound goes back to its original conformational shape and can now bind.
If both lactose and glucose repress, would the bacteria actually use both of them, or does glucose?
So we're going to talk about that. So there's a mechanism to control just that. So we're going to get to that in just a couple of slides. It's a good question. So the answer is, the short answer is that it would use the glucose first, but we're going to talk about why. So this is this one. All right, so then that's the basics of how it works. So how would you actually go about looking for mutations? How was this all figured out? And this was all figured out through genetics. So people found different mutant bacteria that didn't behave the way they were supposed to in terms of regulation or expression of genes. So things that you need to think about is that often mutations in these circuits are going to change expression. So if you have some way to monitor that, or to look for the lack of a response that you expect, then that's great. There's some way that you might do that. So I've just spent all this time telling you how the operator would work. Can you think of some way that you might easily look for that? How would people look to see if the system was working, if the bacteria were using lactose? You guys know anything about the lac operon in terms of actual at the bench work? Do you know anything about lac transcription regions? Do you hear anything about that in previous lectures? So the lac operon is often used in the laboratory not to produce these products to break down lactose, but it's actually used as a transcriptional reporter. So you can fuse promoters to the lac genes, and the production of the beta-galactosidase, that enzyme, you can actually monitor that through an enzymatic reaction. So you've got sort of X-Gal. So you can do blue-white selection. So that's all based off the regulation of the lac operon. So blue-white selection. So you can make transcriptional fusions using some of these systems. So you can imagine that you can make a transcriptional fusion of the promoter of the lac genes and use blue-white selection to actually look for mutants that aren't responding the way they're supposed to. Right? You added lactose or took lactose away. Right? So in terms of thinking about specifically about the lac operon, you can imagine that there are two broad classes that we could probably get. So we could get mutants that would be uninducible. Right? So if they're uninducible, what's that mean? What's the inducer for the lac operon?
Lactose.
All right. So can you tell me a mutation that you might get that would make this bacterium uninducible?
Because it doesn't bind lactose?
Right. So you could get a mutation in the repressor protein, which makes it unable to bind to lactose. Right. So that means that you would have an uninducible system. So you would never see expression of those genes because it couldn't see the inducer. What about a constitutive mutant? Constitutive mutant would constantly express the gene. So what's a potential mutation that you could get that would be constitutive? A mutation in the repressor gene. Repressor, not suppressor, repressor. Right. So you can imagine that if you've got a mutation that either prevented expression of the repressor or prevented the ability of the repressor to bind, then you would have constitutive expression of the genes. So I want you to spend time thinking about what would happen if I mutated this factor in terms of the expression of the genes. Right? And how could you test for those things experimentally? I should also mention the fact that the operator is acting as a cis element. It's a cis-acting element, and the repressor is a trans-acting element. Do you guys remember what cis and trans mean? Anybody?
Maybe one works with DNA and one works with RNA.
Okay, no, that's not quite right.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay, that's right. So the cis element would control the stuff that's actually adjacent to it. So when we talk about the cis configuration, we're usually talking about things that are downstream. They're being controlled together. Okay. Whereas the trans configuration are things that are either found at two different sites or is a factor that can be diffusible to another site and act. So it's acting in trains. All right, so when we talk about different mutations, we talk about whether or not the mutation is actually cis-dominant. All right? And so that's whether or not the mutation is going to affect not only the immediate gene, but also the genes that are downstream of it. All right? So if you think about that, let's go back to a picture of the operon. Right? So if I made a mutation in the promoter sequence here, do you think that would be cis-dominant or cis-recessive? Do you guys know what I mean? Do you know what complementation is? All right, so complementation would be when you would add another copy of the factor that was mutated to the bacterial cell in some way. So usually it's on a plasmid. All right, so it's just a separate copy. It's added what we would call in trans. All right, so it's separate from the actual piece. So if I made a promoter mutation here, what would happen? We would affect the expression of all of these three genes, right? So it would be acting in cis here. But the question is, would it be a dominant mutation or a recessive mutation? What if I now put another copy of the promoter on a plasmid and put that into the cell? Did that promoter on that plasmid drive expression of these genes in the chromosome? No. Right? So then a promoter mutation like that would be a cis-dominant mutation. Yes? It's possible. You could, but that you've actually reverted the mutation now, right? So you haven't complemented it, you reverted it, because you've actually removed the mutation. So do you guys understand the difference between complementation and reversion? So reversion removes the mutation. So you actually make it wild type again. Make it normal. Whereas with complementation, the mutation is still there. You just have an extra copy that's wild type. So those are two very different genetic terms. So they're not the same thing. Unfortunately, in papers, people try to say that they're obviously. So reverting a mutation and complementing are not the same. All right, so then a promoter mutation here would be cis-dominant. What about a mutation in the LAC repressor? Would that be cis-dominant or cis-recessive? So if I made a mutation in the LAC repressor here, and then I put another copy of the LAC repressor onto a plasmid, would that be able to... Right, so that would be able to complement, because expression of the repressor from another site would still be able to diffuse and interact. Right, so that would be a cis-recessive mutation.
Where do you put the repressor?
So I the example I used was that I put it into the bacterial cell in a plasmid.
But if it's not adjacent to its promoter, what?
So in that case, it would have to be able to be expressed. So it's being expressed.
Uh-huh.
So either through its own promoter or from another promoter that you've fused to it. So you assume it's being expressed. If you cloned it and it wasn't expressed, then it would never complement. But it's really not a real test because you haven't even expressed the gene. So it's being expressed some way. Okay. So that's cis and trans. All right, and so I think we've actually just talked about some of this. So constitutive mutants would not respond to regulation. All right. So we talked about an example where you get a constitutive mutation if you mutated the repressor protein so that it couldn't interact. Now, would this be a cis-dominant or a cis-recessive mutation? Okay, got a recessive. And you guys agree? So remember, in complementation, you're always expressing a wild-type copy from somewhere else. mutant form is still there, and then we now express the wild type copy. Would it be recessive or dominant? Recessive. So most people think recessive. So in fact, the question is that the answer is that it could be either recessive or dominant. So it can be recessive if it's a simple matter of the fact that this complex, this tetrameric complex, can interact. But when you put in a wild-type copy, that tetramer can now interact, right? So in that case, it would be cis-recessive. We were able to complement. Looking at this figure, how could you get cis-dominance for the mutation? Remember the fact on this, about four or five of the slides, I said, remember that the repressor acts as a tetramer. So how could you get a cis dominant? That's right. So you can imagine that when the tetramer was formed, it was made of mixed mutant and wild type subunits. Then that could make it non-functional. And in fact, you do find those types of mutations. So we don't know exactly, because we have to have this higher order structure to actually function, we don't know just by saying, okay, there's a mutation in the repressor, we don't know if that's going to be dominant or recessive. So we have to know the nature of the mutation. How does it affect the formation of the tetramer? And is that going to then affect binding? That's correct. That's right. Does that make sense to everyone? So basically, you poison the system.
For that, the repressor subunit can't bond both the dominant and the mutant ones.
So this would be a cis dominant mutation, because adding in the wild type gene doesn't get rid of the phenotype. It's still consistently expressed.
Is that the same?
Yes, so this would be a dominant negative mutation. Because it affects the ability of the wild type to do its job. So it's poisonous to dominant negative. That's correct. I don't think so. So I think you need all four subunits to be completely functional for it. So you have some that couldn't bind lactose and some that could, it wouldn't work. So it would be non-useful. So then your homework assignment is to think about how you could determine whether a mutation was dominant or recessive. How could you experimentally, and when I say homework assignment, this is things that you should think about that might profit you later when it comes exam time. These are the kinds of questions I like to ask on exams. I'm not real big on rote memorization. I'm real big on application of knowledge to solve problems. So if you ask any of the people that have taken the course before, you'll see that the types of questions I usually ask are usually experimental related. So based upon what you know about regulation, how could you design an experiment to look for X, Y, or Z? So think about these kinds of things. All right, so are there any questions about any of that? No? All right, so why don't we go a little bit further? Let's get through the positive part of the regulation, and then we'll take a little break and finish up the rabbit ones. All right, so the other side of the coin here is the fact that you can be positive regulation So this would be where an activator protein would bind and facilitate transcription. And so we often represent that as an activator protein, either helping to recruit the polymerase or interacting with the polymerase in some way to speed up transcription itself. This is different in that, unlike the repressor, the activator usually binds adjacent, right? It's not going to bind typically in the promoter region, because we have to think about that physical blocking of the ability of the polymerase to come in, so it's usually a site that's proximal to the promoter, but not in the promoter itself. And so just like the lac operon is a good example of negative regulation, it also undergoes positive regulation. All right, and that has to do with the fact that glucose, which we call a catabolite, when glucose is present, there's another molecule that's called cyclic AMP that is not formed. All right, and we're going to talk about the mechanism of how that actually occurs, why there's very little cyclic AMP when glucose levels are high. Right? But what happens is if there's no cyclic AMP, then the activator protein, which is called CAP, the catabolite activator protein, isn't activated. Right? So it actually needs cyclic AMP as a co-activator to be functional. Right? So if there's no cyclic AMP, there's no activation of the activator, and therefore you don't see upregulation of the genes. And I want to point out the fact that this is often called catabolite repression. So even though it's actually activation, they call it catabolite repression. And the reason for that is before it was mechanistically figured out how it worked, what they knew is that when glucose was present, you repressed the expression of all these other genes for metabolism of lots of different sugars. So all they knew is those genes were down. But it's actually active. It's actually due to lack of activation and not to repression per se. Okay, so catabolite repression. You'll hear it called that. You might also hear, when both glucose and lactose are present, you might hear that called a dioxic growth pattern. Right? Dioxic growth pattern. And that's because glucose would be used first and then lactose would be used later. So you get two patterns of growth. And so those things are all related. All right, so then what is CAP? So CAP is a positive regulator. All right. Right. Catabolite repression is also called the glucose effect or glucose repression. And this protein, CAP stands for catabolite gene activator protein. It's also known as CRP, which is cyclic AMP receptor protein. So those two words are used interchangeably in the literature just to help add to the confusion. So CAP and CRP are the same thing. And so CAP, this complex of the co-activator and the activator together actually activates more than 100 different genes. So it's very, very well utilized within bacterial cell. And it's common. It's done in lots of different bacteria. So it's used quite a bit. All right, so then what does that actually look like? All right, so we have a low level of cyclic AMP. Then you're going to get CAP produced, and the gene that encodes the CAP protein is the CRP gene. Right? CRP leads to production of CAP or CRP. But in the absence of any cyclic AMP, this isn't going to be active. Right? So it's not going to be able to bind at its target promoters. On the other hand, if you take glucose away and there is no glucose, then suddenly you get production of cyclic AMP. The cyclic AMP binds to the CAP protein activate it, and then it will activate expression of this target gene. So we have a co-activation phenomenon based upon whether or not cyclothane P is being produced or not. Do you guys know what autoregulation is? That's what I mean by autoregulation. It's where the gene product has the ability to regulate its own expression. That's right. So that's correct. Okay. So in this case, CAP is at regulating expression of its own product. And that's a common mechanism that's used by many regulatory groups. So many regulators are auto-regulatory. They control their own expression. So that increases the complexity of the circuit there in terms of what the feedback is available. So when you have enough of the regulatory protein, as well as the co-activator, co-repressor, then feedback and either shuts off, often shuts off the circuit. It's the auto-regulation. Yes?
So if the glucose levels get low, then CAP can, or can't combine CAP, and that will get this whole thing going. Mm-hmm. How does that not affect other genes that should? Is it just because other repressors or something? How does it make?
So it's specific based upon the binding site. So there's a specific binding site that CAP is able to interact. So it doesn't interact non-specifically. It actually binds to a particular DNA sequence.
So all the other 99 would be blocked somehow with a repressor or?
Oh, so no, all of
that's
the,
all
of, you're asking is if you turn on the lactose operon, are you turning on the other 100?
Well, if you activate CAP can't,
mm-hmm.
Can it go and activate other genes?
Yes, so it wouldn't just be turning on this one particular operon, it would also turn on other operons. But that there's complexity in there due to the fact that, okay, so there's a specific binding site. So you can imagine, let's say the binding site, and I don't know exactly how many nucleotides it is, but let's say it's 10 nucleotides. So you have to think there's affinity for binding sites. So maybe when you have a certain level of activated CAP or CAP camp, it binds to high affinity sites. And then as you get more of it, it binds to lower affinity sites, et cetera. So there are all kinds of ways that the bacterial cell can modulate which genes are getting turned on and off. You have to also think about that some of the other 100 genes likely have other regulatory tract proteins, as you mentioned. So there may be other repressors, there may be other things that affect that. So we have to think about those things. So but there probably are lots of genes that are being turned on at the same time as the lactose. But it may not be all 100 based upon those other factors. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So we often talk about things as if they are an all or none. It's usually not an all or none. So there are shades of gray here in terms of if we say no lactose is present. Well, there's probably not very many times when there's absolutely no lactose present or no glucose present. You know, there are always low levels, and so that gives you what we call a rheostat in terms of the gene regulation, right? So you get shades of regulation. Make sense? All right. A couple more slides and then we'll actually maybe we'll stop now. That's getting complex. So why don't we take a break? Say 5-6 minutes. And then we'll actually talk about mechanistically how cyclic AMP levels are controlled and what happens if you have both glucose and lactose in the cell. I'm present in there.
Okay.
You guys can have a copy of it if you want.
I was looking to see how many slides I have left. We're going to speed up. All right. Anybody think any questions while I was gone? It all makes sense. All right, so a lot of that's are kind of a review, right? We cover a lot of that, maybe in a little more detail this time. If you heard that,
So some of the newer stuff we're going to talk about, I think, is we haven't covered before, not in MedMonitor, so it's a little more complex. All right, so the primary question you probably had when I told you that glucose controls the level of cyclic AMP is, gee, how does glucose control the levels? So let's talk about how that happens. So it's basically that occurs due to the fact that cyclic AMP is produced by the action of an enzyme called adenylate cyclase. So when glucose gets brought into the cell, it gets brought in through a PTS system, so it's a transporter that actually brings glucose in, and it is converted to glucose 6-phosphate. That phosphate is actually donated by a component called 2A-glyc phosphate. 2A-glyc phosphate gets converted to 2A-glyc, right? So this PTS system and the conversion of glucose 6-phosphate uses the phosphate, right? The phosphorylated form of GLIC2A actually activates the adenylate cyclase, right? So if you decrease the amount, then you decrease the amount of activation, and therefore you decrease the amount of cyclic AMP that's produced. So less activation of adenylate cyclase due to the import of glucose and the dephosphorylation. That's how cyclic AMP. Sure. Right, so basically you should think in the cell the way cyclic AMP is produced is due to the activity of the adenylate cyclase. Basically what enzyme is going to convert ATP and they're going to end up producing AMP. For this to be active, you actually need to activate the cyclase so it's a function. That activation is accomplished by GLIC2A phosphate, or 2A-glyc phosphate, depending on how you say it. So the level of this particular component in the cell is controlled by the import of glucose. So when glucose gets brought into the cell, so this is the outside of the cell and this is the inside, when it gets brought in through the PTS system, it is converted to glucose 6-phosphate. The phosphoryl group here, the phosphate group here, actually gets donated from GLIC2A. So therefore, if you dephosphorylate this, it's now just 2A-glyc, and therefore there's not high levels of this, which means you don't get activation of the adenylate cyclase. So basically, import of the glucose decreases the activator of the adenylate cyclase, which leads to a decrease of the production of cyclic AMP. Okay, so that's how AMP levels are controlled. And then once again, that you should think about the fact that all of this is, of course, bioregulated too. So glucose is actually decreasing the levels of the activator protein itself. Controls the cell interrupt. It's decreasing not only the activity of gas, but also the amount of gas that is in the cell. Alright, so then schematically or diagrammatically, that's represented here. So if glucose is low, cyclic AMP binds CAP. CAP now binds a binding site called the CAP binding site, which is upstream of the computer. And then that's going to promote interaction with the RNA polymerase, and you're going to see increased expression of these genes. Which means you're going to get more RNA and more proteins produced. Yes? So it's either one of two things. So it either changes the conformation of the DNA, which makes it more accessible for the polymerase. And there are certain cases where Cas actually will interact with the polymerase, so it will actually touch the polymerase. And something about that physical interaction between the two actually speeds transcription and increases the rate of transcription. So those are the two common mechanisms. So either increase recruiting or speeding the rate of transcription. So it's actually touching it, yes. So is DNA always flat?
Yeah.
So you can get looping, bending, and back to the rabinose hopper, and we'll talk about a specific example where you have a region up here and a region up here, the DNA actually bends and interacts. So it's not a flat surface. You block that way. So the Cas protein, the protein itself, has been characterized in E. coli. I just wanted to point out, it, like the alpha subunit of the RNA polymerase, has two different domains. So there's a domain that's important for dimerization. So it acts as a dimer, typically. So meaning two subunits of Cas function together. And that domain is also important for cyclic DNA. Right. And then there is a DNA binding domain, or a helix turn helix domain. You guys heard the phrase helix turn helix, or helix loop helix. So those are typically DNA binding domains. Right. So they interact physically with the DNA. Right. So this would be the domain that actually binds to the DNA. Right. And then once again, just like I showed you with the interaction of the alpha subunit with the up element, the interaction of the locked level. So here you have a Cas site that's very close to the minus 35, and it is actually physically interacting with the alpha, the C terminal portion of the alpha subunit. And so then that's going to increase the rate of transcription. And increase the affinity for the promoter. Right? So it can be very proximal. It can also be more distal. So here, there's still contact between the two, but these two domains of the alpha subunit, they basically have a linker. So it has some flexibility in terms of where it interacts. So here it's not as close. It's more like the minus 100, so you know there's a good 60 base pairs, or 60 bases in between. Okay? So you can get interaction in that way, so the more distal site. You can actually get the Cas binding site directly adjacent to the minus 35, such that physically, probably the C-terminal domain of the alpha subunit is interacting, so it's interacting on the other side. And then you can get a combination. So it's very complex. And once again, that means physically, Cas sites may not always be located in exactly the same place. It's not like the minus 10 to 35. They can be probably multiples that are separated by different amounts of bases. All right. So then there's a little review. If glucose is present, cyclic AMP is going to be low, and if we have no lactose present. So no lactose means that there's going to be the repressor bound, right? So you're going to see this repressed. Okay? Glucose present, so there's no activation and no relieving of the repression by the repressor protein. When we have no glucose, and lactose is present, and we have lots of cyclic AMP, so therefore lots of activation of Cas, so we've got activation. And also, lactose is going to bind and inactivate the repressor, so we have no repression. Okay. Now, what happens if we have glucose and we have lactose? So that's the question. What happens when we have both? Because what you can imagine is if there's glucose, then we're not going to have any cyclic AMP, so the activator protein can't function. But if there's lactose present, lactose should get into the cell and inactivate the repressor. But that's not what occurs. And the reason that doesn't occur is a phenomenon that's called inducer exclusion. So this is what inducer exclusion is. And it, once again, is based upon that enzyme GLIC2A. So we talked about how when glucose comes in, you get this far phosphorylation of dephosphorylation of this enzyme. Right. And then the dephosphorylated form of the GLIC2A is going to actually bind and inhibit the lactose permease. Right. So it actually physically interacts with the protein that's responsible for bringing lactose into the cell and prevents it from getting in. So even though there may be lots of lactose in the broth or in the environment, it can't get into the cytoplasm of the cell. So we excluded the inducer lactose from getting into the cell and being able to relieve the pressure. Make sense? Right. So if you have both lactose and both glucose, the glucose is still going to be used first because the repression can't be relieved due to its inducer exclusion.
Is lactose permease expressed somewhere else too? Is lactose in that lactate or lactate? So if you're not getting the expression of lactate or lactate,
right, so once again, we always talk about these things as all or no. There's a basal level of expression of potential proteins and cells, so there is some there. Okay. So that's our positive regulation. And the next example we're going to talk about is where one regulatory protein has many functions. Really, a single operon, so the arabinose operon, the ARA operon. All right, so here are all the players. All right, so there is a promoter called the PBAD promoter that drives the expression of ARAB, A, and D, which are enzymes that are important for metabolism of arabinose. There's a regulatory protein called ARAC, which is upstream of that, has its own promoter. So PC means promoter for ARAC. And then elsewhere in the gene, there are other operons or single gene units that are controlled. So there's ARA E, F, G, and H, and these encode components that are important for uptake. So diagrammatically, it'd be like this. Here's the uptake system, so L-arabinose can get into the cell, and then these components help in the metabolism. Alright, so then we have all these regulatory regions we have to think about. So here's the PBAD promoter. You guys heard of the PBAD promoter before? Anything else it's used for? Okay, so PBAD is actually a promoter that's often used in labs for controlling expression of proteins. So if you want to overexpress a protein, people often use the PBAD promoter because you can very tightly control it by the addition of L-arabinose. So you'll hear about PBAD expression systems, I would predict, sometime in your graduate career, and probably likely use them, because they're very, very common. And so with the PBAD systems, I've simply just taken this promoter from this and fuse it to whatever gene that you want. Cool. Alright, so then how does this all function? Right, so it's based upon the fact that the regulatory protein, ARA-C, exists in two different states. So there's a, it functions as a dimer, and it works in that, and when there's no arabinose around, it's the dimer is in what's called the P1 state. So in this case, it's going to act as an anti-activator. When arabinose is present, it's able to bind, and now it's in the P2 site, or P2 state, and here it's going to act as an activator. So this is the first time we've mentioned this. What's an anti-activator? You guys heard of that before? Anti-activator? Pretty descriptive name. What do you think it does? It prevents the activator from functioning. Right? So it's different than a repressor. Right? So, because a repressor works by not preventing an activator from working, really. I guess that is repression, but it's a class of repression. So an anti-activator actually prevents the activator from functioning, whereas a repressor is a broader term which may not have anything to do with activation. It may just affect one right spot. Okay. So an anti-activator actually affects the activator itself. Okay. All right, so then we've got two conformational states, P1 and P2, and all of that complex regulatory region. All right, and so I've shown that again here. So here is the structural genes, ARA-BAD. And then there are regulatory regions that are shown here. Right? So ARA-C, here's the regulator. And then there are two operators. So there's operator 1 and operator 2. There's a CAP binding site. So this is can be activated, especially this can be activated by CAP. And then there is a regulatory site here called ARA-I. So those are the sites that are important for the actual function. So what happens is, if there's no arabinose around, ARA-C is going to dimerize. But since there's no arabinose, it's going to be in the P1 form. Okay. So the P1 form of ARA-C has affinity for ARA-I and ARA-O2, so operator 2. So it's going to physically interact with those two sites. And it prevents the ability of any ARA-C in the P2 form to be able to come in and actually interact and cause activation. So it's acting as an anti-activator by preventing the activator from doing its job, being able to do its job. And this is a case where you see you have bending of the DNA to actually get physical interaction. So on the other hand, if you add arabinose, the P1 form is now going to become the P2 form, right? And then the bulk of the P2 is going to bind to the ARA-I region, and it's going to act as an activator. Yes?
Okay, so they both bind to the ARA-I region, but only the anti-activator binds the
O2.
Operator 2 region, and that bending is what makes
it blocks really this, right?
Where does the arabinose, where does it get in there to cause the unbending?
So it has to do with the fact that arabinose, right here, so rather than getting the P1 form, which is the form that causes the bonding, you have the P2 form.
Yeah.
So that structure is not formed. So, or if it is already formed and you add, so you have to think about, once again, we talk about all or none, but there's flux in the system, right? So it's not all or none. It's not locked in and rigid there. It's like you see things that DNA breathes and things come on and off. So
arabinose being stuck through the two little C circles keeps the ARA-O2 coming. what's happening.
So the P2 form of ARC doesn't have any affinity for operator 2. So it can't it doesn't interact there. So only the P1 form has affinity for this particular operator. Yes.
So we say that calculation prevents any P2 form from binding. At what point will P2, or like at what point will that solve?
So once again, it's a gradient, right? So you have to think about it not as an all or none. So probably in any cell, you have low levels of arabinose. So you probably have some level of P2, but it's tipping the scales, right? So when you get enough of the P2 form that's formed and can form this interaction, then you would see expression.
But it's bound like that, and arabinose will access it, and then the arabinose binds there, then it will change?
So, I think that probably that it opens up for the binding. So I don't know if people have actually physically tried to cross-link the DNA and the protein together and then add arabinose to see if it will open. I don't know if that's been done or not. It may have been. But it's probably more of a breathing type situation where you know, the binding is not concrete. It comes off and goes on and goes off and goes on. And that's probably what occurs. And then also, if you get a whole lot of activated ARC, it can also bind and cause repression of itself. So it is also autoregulatory, but it's autoregulatory in the opposite direction to CAP, right? So it's going to repress its expression, whereas CAP activated its expression. So autoregulatory doesn't necessarily mean one way or the other. All right, so then this is just another type of depiction of the same thing. So here's that promoter operator region. Here's a blow-up of it. Here they actually will break it down into a left and a right. So there's I1, I2, operator 1 left, operator 1 right. So it's more complex. They're actually, I see simplified in the other version. It's a single region, but there's really a left and right repeat where the interactions occur. And then here is the structure of the ARC protein. So there's the C-terminal DNA binding domain. And then there's this arm that has a pocket where the arabinose can bind. Right? So in the case of low levels of arabinose, you get a structure here where the O2 is bound to the I region. Right? So you've got physical interaction. Right? But now if we add arabinose, the conformation drastically changes, and interaction at I here is going to promote its expression. It's exactly the same thing as on the other figure, just a little more mechanistic. Make sense? Clear as mud. Go away and look at it when your brain's not quite so full. See if you have questions. I can always come by my office or ask me to answer. That's basically the same thing, just showing the interactions of the alpha subunit of the polymerase, how they think it actually functions. All right, and so now let's think about, given all these facts that you have, how can you now use this information to think about regulation and what to do in the lab and how genetics works? All right, so then there are some broad strategies that we talked about during the course of the day. So we can look for mutants. So we can look for bacterial mutants that have a changed phenotype. They don't respond to the presence of lactose. They're not inducible. They express the lactose genes all the time. So they have some phenotypes. You can look for those mutations. You have a way to screen for them, to select for them. You can then do complementation tests, which we talked about, to determine whether or not the mutation is going to be dominant or recessive. Can it act as a dominant negative? Is it acting as cis? But
is a range that that would.
Could you explain it?
So a complementation test is simply adding back a wild type copy of whatever you're studying, your gene or your promoter or your whatever. So it's a non-mutated copy, and that's added back while still maintaining the original mutation.
And that could be a plasmid.
Could be by a plasmid. Could be. It's typically by plasmids. In some cases, you can't integrate them into the chromosome at a different site. So what we call a neutral site in the chromosome is often done with plasmids. Complementation test. All right, so if you have a recessive mutation, you can figure out whether or not you're looking at repression or activation, and this is usually by phenotype, right? So if you have a mutated activator, right, then you would see no activation. And so in the case of the Lakoff clone, the system would be uninducible. So if we needed the activator, or so would not be, the inducible isn't the right word, it's impressive confusing the galactic, but it would not be activated. It's mutated and activated. So you can see decreased levels of expression. On the other hand, if you had a repressor protein, if you mutated that, then you would lose repression, and so now you would get constitutive expression. So I think a good way to approach this is to actually, take your picture of the lac operon that I gave you and draw a big X through a component and say, okay, now what happens to expression if I take this particular component out of the system? If I take out the repressor, if I take out CAP, if I take out, and then how is that affected by what sugar is present? Glucose is fewer or lactose. And then, of course, every good genetic paper always does have a model of how everything's interacting. If you haven't figured that out from the papers yet, so. All right, so any questions about their lack or error regulation? No, okay. All right, so then let's talk about transcriptional termination. So here we're back to our diagram we started with. So here are the regions that are important for transcriptional initiation. We just did positive and negative. And so now we have to think about termination. And we're going to talk about attenuation specifically. So how does transcription terminate? So transcription stops normally due to the presence of terminator sequences, right? And so the players that are involved here is the actual terminator sequence, the polymerase itself. So the polymerase has to fall off the DNA. And then sometimes we have a factor that's called the rho factor, right? Which actually will facilitate termination. And so if you were to look at that diagrammatically, here would be a promoter where the polymerase comes in, here's an operon, and then often the terminator we talked about, just the normal termination, is at the end of the operon, right? And so those two types of there are two types of terminators we can have. We can have rho-independent or rho-dependent terminators, right? And so that simply means that this one functions in the absence of rho, while the rho-dependent requires rho to actually cause termination to occur. Right? And those are classified basically by structure and sequence. So on the left are shown two types of rho-independent terminators, and on the right is a rho-dependent terminator. So you can see just if you look at them broadly, each of them is a stem loop structure. So there's variable length. Okay. But what you can see if you look at the actual sequence of the row independence is that stem tends to be, have a very rich GC region, so a lot of base pairing of GC. Then there's a run of uracils that will be at the base of the stem. So GC rich stem with a run of uracils at the base. On the other hand, here for the row dependent, it's not particularly GC rich, and there's not a run of uracils at the base. So that means it doesn't function as well, and it actually needs the row factor to help facilitate its function, to cause the polymerase to come off or to stop transcription. So structurally, they're different. All right, and then we talked about attenuation previously. Does everybody remember how attenuation works? Okay, so attenuation is really premature termination of transcription, and it typically occurs at operons for amino acids and bisystems. And so we called this bacterial version of supply and demand. And so whether or not you have your end product around affects whether or not transcription is going to occur or not, whether termination is going to happen prematurely. The whole thing functions based on the fact that in bacteria, transcription and translation there's no nucleus, it's all going on at the same time. Transcription starts, as soon as the message starts to come out, the ribosomes come in and pop. Right? So that's how it functions. And the example that what we've seen before, and probably one of the best studied, is the genes that encode tryptophan biosynthesis. Right, so here is that operon, so there's a promoter operon, and here are the structural genes. These are all the components that are important for actually producing tryptophan inside the cell. Right, and the thing that's a little different here is that in between this promoter operator structure, there is a small peptide that's encoded that's called the leader peptide. So L stands for leader. So here we're talking about in terms of the message. So message is made, leader RNA, mRNA, right? And that encodes a leader peptide, that message. Right? And so here's the actual sequence of the RNA, and then if you were to start saying, well, what are the codons here and what goes in, you can see here are the amino acids that actually go into the peptide. And a few bases or a few amino acids in, you see that there are two codons for tryptophan. So tryptophan is the amino acid that we're trying to produce here, right? So this is the trip operon. So you have two amino acids, or two codons that code for tryptophan, right? So it's the end product of the pathway. The other thing you likely see here is that I've marked a couple of regions, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And those regions, so it's depicted here just linearly, those regions actually have homology with each other. So that means that the messenger RNA has the ability to form secondary structures. It can fold. So 2 is homologous to 1 and 3, so that means it can fold with either 1, and 3 is homologous for 2 and 4. All right, and so depending upon the secondary structure that forms, you're either going to get the formation of a row-independent terminator, or you're going to get the formation of the preemptor structure. So the preemptor structure doesn't look like a terminator. It's stem loop, but it's not GC, particularly GC rich, and it doesn't have the running uracil. All right, so then the question is, what controls what secondary structure occurs? And what controls how the RNA folds? And that is controlled, once again, based upon the fact that transcription and translation are linked. All right, so it's really the location of the ribosome that controls this, controls the folding. So if you have a low level of tryptophan, when the ribosome, so this is the message now that's being produced. Here's the ribosome that's attached and it's moving down, producing the peptide. when it gets to this point, if there's a low level of tryptophan in the cell, that means that there are going to be no charged tryptophan amino acids, right? So that means that there's going to be no trip for the ribosome to actually insert. So it's going to be stuck there. So it's stalled at this region waiting for a tryptophan amino acid to be present. And so that's called starving for trip. All right, so it's sitting there. So while it's sitting there, transcription continues. Right? And then it's sitting in site one here, so two, three, and four form. And you see that two is now going to fold with three. So that structure is the pre-inter structure, and it will, transcription will continue. On the other hand, if there's a lot of trip present, the ribosome's not going to stall here. It's going to quickly continue translating, and it's going to move into region 2, which means that when 3 and 4 are produced, they're going to fold together. Right, so 2 is physically blocked here by the presence of the ribosome. And so with 3 and 4 fold, they make a terminator structure. So then you're going to terminate transcription. Make sense to everybody? Do you remember all of that? So it's that physical interaction of the ribosome with the message that determines how the folding is going to occur. Yes?
How does that stop transcription? Is it the transcriptor already like?
So remember the leader peptide is up here, right? So it's going to basically terminate transcription. So it's going to make a terminator, and so the RNA polymerase is now going to dissociate. It's not going to continue down into the rest of the gene. So you don't, you're not blocking initiation, it's causing premature termination. So here's just another way of looking at that. So if you don't have any tryptophan, the ribosome gets stuck. So 2 and 3 fold. But if there is lots of tryptophan, the ribosome keeps moving and it blocks 2-3 pair pairing and now 3-4 pair in transcriptions. This type of regulation, this attenuation occurs in many different types of amino acid biosynthetic operons. And in just about every case, the regulatory amino acid, that charged amino acid that you need, is going to be the end product of the operon that's being controlled. So here it's to make histidine, and of course, his is the end product. And you see it's actually a huge amount of histidine acids. All right, so it's a very common mechanism that's used in a number of bacteria. So I wanted to also mention the fact that it can occur slightly different in some other organisms. For instance, in Bacillus, based upon a protein RNA interaction between the TRIP messenger RNA. Your protein is called TRAP, T-R-A-P. And so what happens here is that if there's no tryptophan, this is the message for the TRIP operon. It folds into this very complex structure, but you will continue to get transcription. If you now add tryptophan, there's a molecule of protein called TRAP that becomes activated, and then that now comes and binds in this upstream region. So that's going to cause a change in the secondary structure that forms, and you're going to get the production of what looks like a terminator sequence. So you're going to terminate transcription. And so here it's once again, an effect on secondary structure that's completely different molecule. It's not based on a ribosome that's trapped coming in and interacting with the message. Yeah, it's basically exactly the same principle. All right, so then we talked about controlling transcription at the level of initiation or termination. And that's it for today.